morning and welcome back, everybody. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. This morning we're going to have a conversation with Dr. Kianga Yamada Taylor, who's written an incredible book, which we'll talk in much more detail about when she returns here on July 21st, visiting Baltimore to speak at Red Emma's, called From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. She's an assistant professor in the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University and is one of our deepest thinkers, I think, in this country. And we've been wrestling with lots of issues here on the Mark Steiner Show over the last weeks and months, from Black Lives Matter to what's been happening with police killings around the country to issues of organizing and what's happening in our economic crisis in this country for so many people, and why Trump is who he is and why that racial divide exists. So we are about to have the conversation. I want to welcome Dr. Kianga Yamada Taylor to the program. Good to have you with us, Kianga.
Thanks so much, Mark, for having me on. Glad to be here.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. You can email us at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can log on to our Facebook pages, but do call in as you hear the conversation unfold. 410-319-8888 is the number to call. Kianga, there's so much. Where to begin was wrestling in my head all the way up to the moment I walked through the studio door. I was thinking about where we are in the world today. When you look at what Baltimore, you look at what happened in St. Paul and what happened in Baton Rouge, but then you look at what's happening to countries throughout the globe. I mean, whether we're talking about the unrest in Sudan or Dhaka or Baghdad with the explosions, the disruptions in countries like Bangladesh and more, and you begin to feel as if that societies in some ways at this moment in history are actually fraying at the core, that this capitalist system that we have in this world that really dominates the world can no longer answer the questions nor take care of the people in ways that it did at some levels, especially in the West. So I mean, so and how that all fits into what we are kind of wrestling with here in this country now, because they're not disconnected.
Well, I think you can say in this country in particular that the system works and it doesn't work because, you know, it seems like for the corporate elite that their profits have never been better. You know, those people are doing quite well, and I think would say that the system is working the way it has been intended to work, which is to their extreme benefit. But I think for, you know, the vast majority of people, I think that you're right in the sense that we're seeing the extreme shortcomings of free market capitalism. Because when you live in the richest country in the world, and at the same time, you know, there are 47 to 50 million people living in poverty in this country, and that's only designated by this strange artificial poverty line that if you're $1 above, you're no longer poor.
Right.
And so we can imagine that the number is actually quite larger than that. And that doesn't say anything about, you know, people who are maybe a few thousand dollars above that poverty line, but who are working harder for less, who have difficulty affording health insurance, who are sending their kids to schools that are under-resourced, and who are really witnessing the crumbling of the public infrastructure around us. And I think for working-class people, especially Black and Latino working-class people, what is put in the breach of the vacuum that has been left by low wages, unemployment, underemployment, poverty, and a crumbling public infrastructure are the police to basically pin that in, to keep that at bay, but nothing to actually address those conditions in the first place. And I think, you know, there's only so long that people will just tolerate this kind of thing, while at the same time you have elected officials, as they often do, speaking in these grand platitudes about how wonderful the United States is and how the greatness of the United States then emboldens it to have the authority and the audacity, one might say, to go dictate how other people around the globe should be living. And so a few weeks ago, Hillary Clinton gave her big foreign policy speech. And in that speech, she referred to the United States as the last best hope of Earth. And so when you hear things like that and you contrast them to West Baltimore or to Northeast Philadelphia or to the Southeast or Southwest side of Chicago or any South or West side of any city in the United States, there's a big disconnect and it angers people. And so I think that, you know, over the last several years, really, I would say, since the emergence of the Occupy movement, that we've seen a consistent kind of reaction that sometimes flares in a very dramatic way, as we saw in the summer of 2014, and as we've witnessed over the last week, where people are really expressing an extreme discontent with the way that things are organized in the society right now.
And, you know, I think in describing that, I mean, there is a disconnect in our country, and of course, built around race, that when you look at the anger of people who are surrounding Donald Trump, and a lot of those people who are surrounding Donald Trump are working class white people and white men in particular. And sometimes we can just easily dismiss them as just being racist, which is why they're there. But racism plays a deep role in this, obviously. But there's a complexity to this. It's a complexity we have a hard time kind of wrestling with when we're trying to figure out how do you move things ahead to change things.
Well, racism is an easy way for people like Donald Trump and really the Republican Party in general who have nothing to offer these people. They have nothing concrete to offer. And so racism is an easy and cheap way to rally the troops. Without having to promise anything. Because it's basically you just blame other people for the situation that you're in. You blame immigrants, you blame the blacks who don't want to work and who just want to live off the system, neglecting to understand that there really is no more welfare in this country. But there's a deeper reality that you're talking about that I think is really important and that the left has to relate to in such a way that goes beyond just sort of making fun of people or shaking your finger at people to really understand the profound depth of the economic crisis in this country. I mean, there are 20 million poor white people who live in the United States, and it's the same thing. You know, a few dollars above the poverty line and you're no longer counted. And so we're talking about tens of millions of poor white people who have seen their futures completely wiped out, also because of the lack of manufacturing that happens in this country, and who have many of the same sort of economic insecurities. They don't have the added burden, usually, of police violence and police terrorism, although if you look at the numbers, the Black people and Latino people and Native people are disproportionately killed by the police. But American police kill hundreds, if not thousands, of white people, you know, over the last several years. They certainly kill hundreds of white people a year, but over the last several years, they've killed literally thousands of white people. And so I think that, you know, in this country in general, poverty and the poor are hidden. And when they are discussed at all, it usually has a black face, which becomes the pretext for talking about people's personal irresponsibility, their lack of morality, or some other kind of personal defect that is used to explain that situation away. For white poor people, they are completely invisible because to introduce poor white people into the discussion would raise too many questions about the what this system is to have, you know, this number of poor white people who apparently don't have the same problems as the personally dysfunctional black population.
Right.
And so we just don't talk about them at all. And I think that it's a mistake for the left to reflect that kind of marginalization. And there's an argument that has to be put out and that has to be made about the collective interest that ordinary black people, Latino people, white people, that ordinary people in general in this country have in uniting their struggles against the people who are benefiting from the system right now.
And I think that, well, I'm going to open the phones here at 410-319-8888 as we have a conversation with Dr. Kianga Yamada Taylor about where we are in this world today. She's the author of Black Lives Matter, It's a Black Liberation, a book I'm in the middle of now, which is just one of the most interesting books I've read in a long time. I'm looking forward to having a lengthy conversation just about the book. Y'all can join us here again at 410-319-8888. And what you were just saying, we're actually this Friday, we'll be sharing an interview that I did with Nancy Eisenberg on her book, White Trash, which is about the history of poor white people in America and what that history means. It's a really interesting book. But let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888, your thoughts. And Marie, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I've been trying to get to you for 2 days.
I'm so sorry, Marie. The lines have been jammed. I do apologize. Go ahead.
I can understand. And I'm going to tell you about something that's going on at the Reginald Lewis Museum. If you've already heard about it, then I'll just move on.
What is that?
They have a film called Question Bridge, Black Males. Have you already talked about that before?
Last week we did, but tell us what you want to tell us.
Well, about the film. Did you see the film there?
I have not seen the film yet. We did talk about that.
Oh,
we talked with him about the film.
Go see the film. The innovative video installation weaves questions and answers by black men to black men to simulate a real-time conversation. The authenticity and generosity of the men problems complex and authentic images of black men rarely seen in the American media. When you see this film, Mark, you will see three walls of film, and these walls are talking to each other, and they're talking to me. I thought the film was 2 hours long, but the receptionist said, you've been sitting up there 4 hours watching this. So please see this film. You'll see Jesse Williams.
Yes.
The one who won an award. And call them if you want to know about the price. It's very low price.
It is low price, though, yes.
And so sit in that room, and the pictures of these individual men are most high as the ceiling.
Well, Maria, so, I appreciate the call and the heads up, and I'm going to go down and see the film. And once we do, maybe we'll have a second conversation about the film exactly by itself. So I'm glad you got through.
Bye.
Thank you so much.
So
let me get another call in here. For Kianga, 410-319-8888. Sure. You were about to say something, Kianga?
No. Okay. Yeah, let's get another caller.
Let's go to Robert on line 4. You're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Robert. You there? Do we have line 4 rolling? Oh, let's go to Mojo then on line 3.
Okay. Hello.
Good morning, Mojo.
Yes. This is Robert.
This is Robert. Okay. I'm not sure what's happening. I got all kinds of. Okay. Robert, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. First, I want to say thanks for allowing me to speak to your program, Mr. Stein.
It's good to have you here.
I basically want to say that, you know, I've heard this narrative of the comparison between the fatal interaction between blacks with police and whites with police. And what I've been hearing now for the last few days is how more whites are actually killed by police than blacks. And that may be true, but it's true for two reasons. And first, obviously, the whole number factor, the fact that, you know, blacks are only about 13% of the population, and black males are about maybe 6% of the overall population. But another reason why that may be true is because of other than numbers is the fact that You know, when whites have a tendency to enact the police, where I got results in a fatal incident, the threshold for them is much higher. For example, I was reading the news earlier this week how, like, there was one white gentleman, I think down in either North or South Carolina. This guy had a pistol and a gun. He had shot a few rounds off at cars. He had threatened a police officer, and they literally manhandled him and disarmed him. Whereas, so we all know if the situation were, you know, and I only went ahead to go there because that's pretty much all that I'm going to say.
Right, right.
But my point, though, is that the threshold, the tolerance of the police dealing with blacks versus whites is much lower. And we all know that anytime you can kill a 12-year-old boy with a toy gun, and at the same time body slam his sister who's crying and screaming, and then put her in the back of a police car, and yet you're able to take a guy who killed 30-something people in a movie theater or killed 8 people that are praying in church and take him alive, a proving killer, whereas a black child who hasn't killed anyone is killed in 12 seconds, we have a problem. That's all I want to say.
John, I appreciate the call. I mean, Robert, I appreciate the call. Kianga, I mean, I think that...
Because that wasn't my point. My point wasn't that, well, you know, more white people get killed by the police. I think I said that the police disproportionately kill black and Latino people and Native people by far. My point was that there is a problem with the police in this country, and they are killing, you know, over 1,000 people a year. And when you look at that in comparison to what happens in other countries, in Canada last year, the police killed 25 people in the entire country. I mean, in the United States, the police have already killed 18 people since July 1st. And so there is a problem with the police in general. There's a particular problem with racism in the police and the way in which police are deployed, the neighborhoods that police are in. And when we look at the high numbers of black people who are incarcerated, who are engaged with the criminal justice system, all of that begins with encounters with the police. But we can't, I think, ignore the larger reality within which that is happening, is that police aren't out of control. They have been deployed to do this, but that it has a wide-ranging impact. And so I think that's important because I think it establishes a basis upon which to build an even broader movement that is beyond just African-Americans or Latinos who are directly affected, but that can make alliances with white people who are affected by police overreach as well. And I think that when we start thinking about how do we challenge this, what is it that we have to do to challenge it? As the caller said, black people are only 12% of the population. 12% of the population isn't going to stop what the police are doing, isn't going to stop the political establishment who use the police to maintain order. And so we have to build as broad a movement as possible, and that the ability to do that doesn't rest upon recruiting white people to our struggle because they feel bad for black people. It also it includes pointing out the way that the policing state and the way that the growth of police powers has an impact on their lives as well. And so that's the only point that I'm trying to make.
I think that this is the kind of complexity that has always stymied the United States and stymied movements that have tried to build for social change in this country. Whether you're talking about the roots of the 1930s, when people were talking about equal rights for Negroes, and remember the Scottsboro mm-hmm. Boys, to the Freedom Now struggles of the 60s, to Black Lives Matter today. I mean, that there's always been this kind of cross fertilization, but racism. And the hatred of racism and racism itself have always been able to split everything wide open,
right?
So that, you know, it's really hard to have that kind of unity in the face of the depth of racism that travels the marrow of the society.
It's true, but at the same time, that struggle exists, that when there is struggle, it raises the possibility of creating unity around a particular issue. And so I think that before the rise of Ferguson and the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, I think that the vast majority of white people in the United States would say that, well, sure, there's police brutality, but, you know, this is a few bad apples, a few rogue cops.
Right.
That in reality, there's nothing systemic about this. I think now, even though there's probably a majority who still say that, it's much smaller, that there's a greater number of white people who see that this is systemic, and this isn't just a question of a few rogue cops going off on their own. And I think if you look closely at the protests that have happened over the last week, these are not all black protests, and these are not all, you know, protests of only people of color. There are many white people who are on these protests as well. And I'm probably sure that in most of those cases, it's not because they have a personal situation with police brutality, although some of them may. But there's an extent to which I think, especially for younger people, that they see what is happening in this country, and it's disgusting, and it disgusts them, and they want to do something. They want to do something about it. It is difficult to look at what police are doing right now and not be completely outraged, especially if you put that in connection with all of these other issues that are happening, the issues with unemployment, the issues with poverty, the issues with the low minimum wage, the issues with the attacks on public education in this country. And so I think for young people in particular, that this is a moment in which people are making decisions about what they want to do with their lives and their time in terms of the struggle for social justice. And I think that we have to be open to that, and that we have to be thinking about how do we build the biggest, broadest movement possible that can actually stand up to the political status quo. Because if we have to hear one more speech from Obama about the tone of the movement and, you know, we have to be nice to the police officers, and then let's have another summit, let's have another round table, let's invite the activists back to the White House to talk about these issues. It's insufficient. It's insufficient to what is happening. They tried it 2 years ago. People stood down to wait and see, in some sense, what would come of Obama's intervention. There was a report released on policing that came out of a commission he organized in March of 2015, and not one single one of the 59 recommendations that came out of the report have been implemented in any serious way. And so here we are, a year and a half later, in the same situation. And people see this. People are not stupid. They see this. And, you know, I think there's a feeling that we have to do something about this. We can no longer entrust our elected officials to figure this out. We have to do something.
We're talking to Dr. Kianga Yamada-Taylor, and we'll be right back with her. Stay with us. Mojo and John, we're going to come right to your calls as soon as we come back from this very brief break to talk to her, the author of this incredible book, Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. Stay with us. Don't go away. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Kianga Yamada-Taylor, who's assistant professor in the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University, author of the book Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. She'll be coming to Baltimore to talk about that book on July 21st, Thursday, July 21st, at 7:30 p.m. at Red Emma's at 30 West North Avenue. And we hope to have her here in the studio to talk about her book before that event as well, to really get into the depth of all she's written. As Michelle Alexander said, as she wrote in the back of the book, Kianga Yamada-Taylor's researching examination of social, political, and economic dimensions of the prevailing racial order offers important context for understanding the necessities of the emerging movement for black liberation. And so we look forward to continuing these conversations with her and this hour as well. So let's get right to the phones at 410-319-8888. And you can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Let me see. We have a tweet here from Cham Green. And Cham tweets in, "It depends on what type of whites. There is something about the cops. There's something about me cops detest." I'm not sure quite what that means, but I guess, again, we have this thing. I think, you know, you were talking about the nature of struggle a moment ago. And I think that, you know, it really is hard to overcome. I mean, because it's so easily divided. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can remember being the age I am, that when the woodworkers were organizing a union on the borders of Mississippi and Alabama back in the late in the 70s. And they were almost evenly divided between black and white workers. But because of the depth of racism that took place, they were able to split and kill that union until the women got together, the wives, and they organized and forced the issue and forced the men into a different situation. And so the union actually, I don't know where they are now, but for a period they actually flourished. But it's really hard to overcome that, because that there is that block in America that stops things from happening unless there's a way for people to unite around certain things. And for, I think, people who are white working class, whoever you are in America, to really come to grips with what racism is and what it's done to us.
Well, I don't think that unity across racial lines in the United States especially is automatic, or that it happens just because it's a good idea, or that it happens because it should. That it usually happens in situations like what you just described of the woodworkers in the South, which is when there is a political intervention, in this case by the wives of these male workers, that makes an argument and makes a case for why it's important. And that its importance is not based on us all feeling good about each other. It's not based on, you know, that this is something that should happen so we can all be morally pure, but that it's really strategic in looking at what it is that we have to gain by uniting, or what it is that we have to lose. And that's a political argument, and it means that people who have some sense of history, people who have some sense of the overall dynamic within this country of, yes, there is certainly a racial divide where even your average white person has all sorts of advantages over black people in every way that you can imagine. So there's no denying that. But we have more to gain by uniting around particular issues, or do we have more to lose? And so I think that is the guiding question. And so I think there are even current examples where we can look at where people have decided in a particular situation that they had more to gain by working together, whether it was the Verizon strike from just a couple of months ago, 40,000 workers in a very multiracial, multi-ethnic workforce who put whatever other divisions, disagreements, different lives all together in some ways outside of the workplace to the side to fight together against their employer, who is literally raking in billions of dollars each year and asking workers to work harder for less. You could look at the Chicago teachers strike from 2012, where black and white teachers primarily had to put aside any number of political differences and disagreements that they have about any number of things, including what one's attitude should be towards the police. You have to put that to the side momentarily to fight around these particular issues involving education for their sake and for the sake of the children in the classroom. And so these are, you know, I think two more recent examples, but those kinds of things happen I think, fairly regularly. Whether or not that political commitment is maintained over the long haul is also a political question, because the pressure in this society is always towards division, from whether it's popular culture, whether it's from mainstream politics, whether it's the education system, whatever it is, the whole entire weight of our society is towards people being divided. And so that, you know, it's incredibly difficult. It's incredibly complex, but it really is at the core of whether or not we will have successful movements in this country.
We're talking to Dr. Kianga Yamada-Taylor, and you at 410-319-8888. As I promised to the phones here, Mojo and John, Russ, we're going to come to your calls in that order. And Mojo, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. Good morning.
I'd like to talk about the Black Lives Matter movement.
Sure.
I have a unique take on that. Excuse me if I'm speaking kind of fast, but when I think of Black Lives Matter, I think that you can look at any element of society, whether it's white, Asian, Chinese, Japanese, and when I look at those elements, I think that's the best that God has to offer. You know, that's the best that God can make us. But you have to also look at there are other elements of those which we ourselves reduce ourselves to, and you can think of words for every one of the groups that I've just mentioned and have to realize that Black lives don't matter to those people. You know,
mm-hmm.
because there are certain elements of the African-American society that Black lives don't matter to. There are certain elements of the white society you can name, you can have, you know, come up with colorful names. It doesn't matter to those people. When I think about Black Lives Matter, I think about the things that's happening with the police, and I think that some people try to distract and say, what about black-on-black crime? But I look at police have guns, dogs, communication systems, helicopters, you know, all this training. They have all of these things, but they can't weed out the, you know, those bad elements. Not to make it perfect, because, you know, you can't make it perfect, but you have to realize, like Craig Schrock said, when you meet somebody, you're meeting their representative, and within a short while, you'll meet the real person. And you can't tell me that the cops have never met the real person of who these rogue cops are. And if they haven't spoken out, then the blood of those cops that were killed is on their hands. Because just like if you have a child, you try to raise a child, and you don't teach them the right things, and your child goes out here and kills someone, their blood is on your hands. Your child's blood is on your hands if they get killed. So how do they expect black people to come to court and testify when they don't even come to court and testify, and they have all of these things to protect themselves, when the most we can have is a gun that we can get a license for at home, and if you're in the security business, you can carry it back and forth. But other than that, we don't have anything else to protect us from the bad elements that don't think that Black lives matter. So they want us to come to court and testify. We need their help. We need the community
to
come to court. But they won't even come to court and testify against the rogue ones. So you have good police officers.
Sir? Go ahead, Bunjo. Just finish up so we can get back.
You have good police officers, and I know a lot of good police officers, but you have bad police officers. If you didn't, if somebody believes that there's not bad police officers, then they're living a pipe dream. But black lives don't matter. We have to realize it doesn't matter to the N-word, to the C-word, to whatever you want to name any element of society. But it does matter to white people, because I have white friends who I feel love me, who I've seen over the years, 15, 20 years, how they interact with black people and really debate them on certain things. So I know where their heart is, but I know there are white people who are, you know, the bad element who don't who don't get it.
Mojo, you raise a whole lot of issues here. Kianga, I think that there's a lot of complexity in what Mojo threw out here.
Yeah, I guess the one thing, or maybe two things that I would say, is that I think Black Lives Matter is really addressed to the society at large. And, of course, there are individual whites, entire neighborhoods or groups of white people who do believe that, who do think that Black Lives Matter. And those are the same people, I'm sure, that we see on the protests, you know, not just over the last week, but who were at the protests to the various protests to bring down the Confederate flag, and who were at solidarity protests in the first iteration of the movement in 2014. But I think the slogan and the hashtag Black Lives Matter is addressed to the society at large, a society that sees the kind of disparities that separate Black life from the rest of our country, through no fault of Black people, I would argue, but as a result of systemic and institutional racism that has disadvantaged Black communities over several decades, over many decades, in such a way that it no longer matters the individual attitudes of whites in business or in public institutions, that these patterns have been established over many decades, and that there has to be active action from the federal government to undo those patterns. So that's one thing. And then the other thing about the police is, you know, I don't think that it really matters if they're, you know, good police, the whole dichotomy of good police and bad police. You know, not all police have murdered people or anything like that. But it's policing itself, regardless of the intention of the individual officers in this country, is completely oppressive. And, you know, I think that there are any number of examples of that, that regardless of whether you consider yourself a quote-unquote good cop or bad cop, there's only, you know, a handful of neighborhoods that the police are deployed in. I mean, in my neighborhood in Philadelphia, you know, which is not, it's called Mount Airy. It's, you know, it's about 50% Black, 50% white. But it's certainly known as a middle-class neighborhood. I never see the police. I mean, when I do see the police, it's noteworthy that, oh, there are police here. in Northeast Philadelphia, I mean, you can't like spit without hitting a cop, you know, and the police are absolutely everywhere. And so when you're deployed to an area and the expectation is that you are arresting people, because now we have politicized rising crime rates, lowering crime rates, so that there's pressure on police to actually arrest people, to document the progress that they're making. It doesn't matter your personal intentions. You're either doing the job or you're not. And doing the job often results in, you know, an oppressive condition for Black people. And so I think this is the problem with the reform discussion, is that it's sort of just looking at the individual behavior of this or that cop and saying, oh, we can change the behavior, without thinking more generally about what is policing in this country? Why has it always been oppressive? There is not a single period in American history you can point to where the police were not racist, abusive, and causing harm to Black people. And so why is that? And what does that say about the nature of the institution of policing in the United States? Those are the questions that we have to ask and get away from, is this cop good? Is that cop bad? Does this cop have a good attitude? Does that cop have a bad attitude?
We're talking with Dr. Kiyange Amada-Taylor we have a ranging conversation here this morning. And let's go back to the phones, get another caller in here, 410-319-8888. And we said we'd go to John. John, you're on the air, line 4. Welcome.
Hello. I keep on being reminded of the book, I think one of the most important books this year, Listen Liberal by Thomas Franks, where it really brings down the Democratic Party now is the basically the party of the top 10%, professional managerial class, And I've seen this develop over the years. I go all the way back to the 60s. I go back to, Bill O'Connor, Jerry Ratzig, Dean Pappas, Annie War, all that stuff.
Right.
And I basically see that, and you've alluded to it, but I think it's up to the left to do the Nixon goes to China thing. I think the left has become totally obsessed, and I use that word, obsessed with race, and to a certain extent, gender. I think they've really forgotten working class people and the class element. I think they've got to reach out to white working class people. All those people that I've heard on the radio in this call-in shows, this election cycle, saying, well, I'm going to vote for Bernie Sanders or maybe Donald Trump. Now, what are these people? Are these people like revolutionary socialists or racist Ku Kluxers? You know? I don't think they are, and I think the left—it's really up to the left to reevaluate some of their positions over the last few decades and where it's gotten us today. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Kiaga.
Well, I would say that I think it's wrong to characterize the left's attention to anti-racist struggle as an obsession with racism.
Mm-hmm.
I think racism is the most pronounced and important divide among working class people. And so it actually has to be attended to, because if you don't take the struggle against racism seriously, you will never win black people to left struggles, to left organizing, to being an active element, an active part of the left. And, you know, why would black people? I think this was the problem that the Communist Party faced in the 19-teens and the 1920s, was treating the problems of black people as only a class issue, meant that black people didn't join the Communist Party because they wanted to join organizations that were actually going to fight their added burden of racism. So black people, black working class people, kept the burden of being working class and all that that means and the oppression that comes with being working class. But they have the added burden of race in a racist country. And so the left has to actually take that seriously. And it doesn't mean that you can't convince white workers, white working class people, that race is also important to their to their struggle as well. And so I think that you know, there are very concrete examples of that. One is, you know, when Clinton in 1996 ended welfare by using racism and painting it as a program that only benefited black people. And literally calling the bill to end welfare the Personal Responsibility Act. And then Clinton has a signing ceremony to sign that bill in the Rose Garden and surrounded himself with black women. But the reality is, at that point in time, the majority of people who were dependent on welfare were white women. And so racism was used to not only undercut black women, but also to undercut white women who were in need of a social safety net. We can look at the cost of a prison, of maintaining prisons in the United States. It's $80 billion a year. Now, of course, this has disproportionately impacted black communities, absolutely. But when we have $80 billion of taxpayer money going to maintain prisons on a racist premise, that also impacts white working class people as well. So when I talk about uniting the struggle around race and class, it's not about finding the lowest common denominator that we can all agree on, and that is the least offensive to white people, so therefore we won't talk about race. No, it's about raising the political level of white people to understand how racism has a detrimental impact on their own future. And that's the challenge. That's why it's difficult. But we certainly, if the attitude is, oh, the left is obsessed with race. We have to stop talking about that and just talk about class. Well, that's a perfect way to keep the movement fractured and ununified.
And I would just also point out, which we'll link to on our webpage with this podcast later. Kianga wrote an incredibly interesting article for a Jacobin called "What About Racism?" And that kind of outlines what she says here, but also I think goes into greater depth as well. So, and if we had more time, I would really delve into that. But I promised my listeners we would get to them today, and I want to get to them to join this conversation with Kianga Yamada Taylor at 410-319-8888. Rush, you're on the air. Welcome.
To you and your lovely guests. Mark, there are three quick things I'd like to say before I head to the meat of my thing. Number one, NRA was saying the best way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Well, they were established as an open carry, and there were a lot of people with weapons at that event, but could have led to catastrophe. And I think we ought to pay attention to that, because the people who got the job done were the professionals, not the other open carry people. Two, I think that John's call to me was blaming black people for slavery and the conditions imposed on them coming forward. We got to stop that. And the third thing I was saying is so what Mo said, the first caller, that there are good cops out there. Well, you can't be a good cop if you're sitting next to a bad cop. If you're sitting next to somebody mm-hmm. that's breaking SOP and doing things that you know are illegal in your own mind and heart and wouldn't do, you're not a good cop. But what I called to say, Mark, is that circa 1948 to 52, in Alabama, they had a governor by the name of Big Jim Folsom.
Right.
And Mr. Folsom, Governor Folsom, was a unique Republican, because he said, and I'm going to try to quote him word for word out of memory, he said, race is a phony issue. It's a ploy used by rich and powerful people to keep poor people divided and blind to their common interests. I think that's a statement every American should take into their heart and think about for a minute, because you wonder why, how could we get to where we are? Well, let's look at it from my point of view in my lifetime. We had Eisenhower. Came in, he had to enforce some laws that he really didn't like, so what did he do? He put the FHA in place. Now that we got redlining and the other things that took property value away from black people. Then Nixon comes along, silent majority. And then Reagan comes along, not hiding anything at all, goes into Shelby County, Mississippi to announce his presidential run and gives a states' rights speech in the place where three civil rights icons, two white, Goodman and Swerner and Cheney, the black guy, was killed by the Ku Klux Klan, including law enforcement fortune. Then we get Willie Horton. And then we get, excuse me. But, I mean, you see where I'm going with this.
Right, right.
All of the politicians have used euphemisms to tell white folks that the advances that blacks are making are coming out of their hides. So these people are mad because they feel like they've been taken advantage of, put upon. That everything the black guy gets, it takes out of a zero sum from what they're supposed to get. They blame blacks or immigrants for this low wage situation. But really, if you look at what's happened, is they have allowed unions to fold up and blow away. And that's why the management now represents the worker. And what do you think he's going to do? Watch out for his bottom line or the workers? So where I'm trying to go with this is to say that we have got to understand that we've gone about as far as the law can take us. And the problem now is overcoming the image of blacks in white sides. To somehow figure out how we're going to take what we want to do, like today, we're having a sane, rational, objective conversation about the situation. But that's the wrong yardstick, because we're dealing with a subject that is irrational, wholly subjective, and I think somewhat rooted in insanity. So how do you get another human being to see and accept you in a humane way, humanity speaking, as he sees him or herself? I think that's what we need to get to, and I don't know how to do it. I wish I did.
Mm-hmm. Russ, that's a great thoughts here. And by the way, Big Jim Folsom was actually a Democrat, but that's all right. It's all blurred anyway. But Kianga?
To be honest, I think that the way that we do that, and I think, it's a very smart comment, but I think that the way that we do that is through struggle, and that the movement, as long as the movement is on the streets, I think that we have a greater ability to have more clarity and understanding, because it means that the issue can't be pushed to the side. It can't be marginalized. And we think about how the discussion around these issues concerning police has transformed in the last 2 years, compared to 10 or 15 years ago, it's been because people were in the streets. So think about how attitudes changed over the course of the 1960s into the 1970s in terms of, you know, how white people felt about black people, how white people viewed black people. I think those things transformed, even if it was even if it was limited and halting. I think it's undeniable that white attitudes about black people transformed over the course of the 1960s. I mean, people always sort of mark how you could no longer use, you know, sort of explicitly racist language by the late 60s and 1970s. And the question is, well, why? Why not? You know, was there some directive from the president's office that you could no longer use explicitly racist language? Well, no, I think that racism became an embarrassment. People were embarrassed to be identified as racist on the one hand. I think on the other hand, a lot of people's ideas about this sort of, you know, questioning the humanity of black people changed. And that came about through struggle, because it's difficult to characterize people who are getting killed for the right to vote, people who are sitting in, who are demonstrating, even people who are in open rebellion. But for 4 years straight in over almost 300 cities, it's difficult to say that those people don't care about what happens to them. It's difficult to say then that, oh, they just, you know, have a culture of poverty and are irresponsible. It's difficult for that logic to maintain itself, because if that were true, then why do anything? You know, people would just be hanging out. And so I think today, the struggle in the streets is what keeps the discussion alive. It's what keeps the question about why are those people in the streets alive. And it becomes difficult, if not impossible, to marginalize and to change the page. And then I think for the movement itself, it has to clearly articulate what it is, what it wants, what it's fighting for, and what extent it will go to in order to obtain that, to help give the broader public language to understand what is happening. And I think that's the process by which people's attitudes not only change, but they begin to see some commonality in their own struggles. I mean, I think the opioid crisis among white people, I mean, people always talk about the difference between how black addicts were treated versus whites. And I think that's totally legitimate, and it's absolutely true. But then beyond that, what does that say about what life is like in this country? That you literally have the number of people who've died from overdoses has quadrupled in the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. Even white people are drinking and drugging themselves to death to escape the reality that exists in the United States.
The
struggle gives people a model for what you can do to confront that situation.
So I really enjoyed this conversation immensely. We've been talking here with Dr. Kianga Yamada Taylor. Her book, Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, she'll be in Baltimore July 21st on Thursday at 7:30 p.m. at Red Emma's. We'll be talking to her before that about her book in its entirety. And Kianga Yamada Taylor, thank you so much for being part of the show today. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks for having me, Mark. Take care.
Take care. And we'll take a short break here and come right back. And on our way to break, we just want you to stay with us and do not go away. We're going to meet the folks from Perkins Homes, talk about what's happening in that community that is confronting housing in the city and where the future of that goes. Don't go away.